Philip Sheehan is an investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times, and author of a best-selling book on the 9/11 Commission. His new book is an expose on the Warren Commission and the aftermath following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago. Ultimately, it's a work that begs the answer, what have we learned from the years between Dallas on November 22, 1963, and September 11, 2001, about communications between our most powerful government agencies. His new book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And we welcome Philip Sheehan to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Joe, thanks for having me.
It is a delight to have you here. A Cruel and Shocking Act, that is a phrase that actually comes from the Warren Commission report.
Yeah, the introduction described the assassination as a cruel and shocking act against the nation and against all mankind.
When it comes to what you wanted to accomplish with the book, the set of questions you had before you were what?
Well, this book begins in 2008. I got a phone call at my desk in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and the caller was a very prominent American lawyer who explained that he had begun his career almost 50 years earlier on the staff of the Warren Commission investigating the Kennedy assassination. That year, I had just published a book about the 9/11 Commission, and he suggested that I do a similar book about the Warren Commission. He said that there were a lot of great stories that had never been told about the Warren Commission. You know, it's the ultimate homicide investigation. And he would introduce me to the other staff lawyers who'd worked on the commission and who were still alive and able to talk. And I was on my way. And what happened pretty quickly, though, is that the book became much bigger because these guys started pointing me in the direction of witnesses and evidence that had never reached the Warren Commission and that seemed in many ways to sort of rewrite the history of the assassination.
So much about this book is interesting, and one of the things that you take great pains to do is to create this cast of characters. And I'm curious as to what it was like for you to get all the players lined up.
Well, it was complicated, but I got to tell you, I thought, short of the Founding Fathers, I have the best cast of characters in history. You know, everybody from J. Edgar Hoover to Robert Kennedy to Jackie Kennedy to Earl Warren to these very craven spies at the CIA. But it's a big cast of characters, and I do my best to introduce them in sort of a novelistic way.
When you look at the actual Warren Commission and how it was compiled, I mean, that in and of itself is a fascinating story of how it came to be, because it was a thankless job.
Well, I mean, originally there wasn't going to be a commission. President Johnson, who obviously is thrust into power, he doesn't want a big federal investigation. He wants to leave this to the officials in his home state of Texas. He says he doesn't want a bunch of, he describes them as carpetbaggers going in from Washington to Texas to carry this out. But within days, these conspiracy theories start flying pretty wildly, both, around the country and around the world. And some of them suggest that Lyndon Johnson killed President Kennedy. And Johnson becomes very worried about that, and he decides there has to be a federal investigation that will put to rest a lot of those rumors. And he decides that there's only one man to run it, this man he sees as sort of the symbol of integrity, and that's Chief Justice Earl Warren. Warren absolutely does not want the job. He refuses it. And after he refuses it, he finds himself ordered to the Oval Office, where he confronts President Johnson, a man he doesn't really know, who is literally in Warren's face, telling Warren that unless he takes the job, there may be World War III, and that Warren will be responsible for World War III. And apparently at the end of this, Earl Warren is left in tears and has agreed to take the job, even though he absolutely does not want to be involved in this.
And of course, he enters this job, and not only is there great pressure, but there is also the family connection, which is Robert Kennedy, who has many questions of his own to answer.
Well, Robert Kennedy's involvement in this story, I find very troubling from start to finish, because he many times said publicly that he believed the Warren Commission. He was convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone. And what we now know is that that was never true. that Robert Kennedy, right from the start, believed that there had been some sort of conspiracy behind his brother's death, and he keeps this away entirely from the Warren Commission and away from the public for reasons that I find pretty baffling, except I suspect there were secrets that Robert Kennedy wanted to keep too.
When you look at secrets and things that have been kept, obviously a lot of this book has to do with Lee Harvey Oswald and what was known about him, what was known beforehand, both by the CIA and the FBI, and really as short a period of time as a month before the murder.
Well, you know, that is really the amazing thing about all this, is that it turns out that both the FBI and the CIA had Lee Harvey Oswald under surveillance before the assassination. You know, the FBI had him under surveillance for months and months and months. And the question becomes, didn't either of these agencies, the FBI or the CIA, have information that would have suggested that Oswald was a threat to President Kennedy? You know, and shouldn't somebody have warned the Secret Service about that before Kennedy arrived in Dallas? And the answer is yes. Both of those agencies, the CIA and the FBI, had strong evidence of the threat that Oswald might pose. And, you know, because they didn't want to be blamed for the assassination, they go out of their way to hide that evidence from the Warren Commission.
Both the CIA and the FBI, you charge in the book, hid information, vital information, a lot of it having to do with Lee Harvey Oswald's trip to Mexico City, suggesting a Cuban connection.
Well, you know, this whole business about Mexico City just came as news to me. You know, I didn't know anything about it, and I sort of see it as the missing chapter in the history of the assassination of President Kennedy, because Oswald goes to Mexico City 7 weeks before the assassination. He's there apparently to get visa papers that will allow him to defect to Cuba, much as he had tried to defect to Russia 4 years earlier. And while he's in Mexico City, he's dealing with Cuban spies and Russian spies and Mexicans who are supporters of Castro's revolution, a lot of whom at this moment, at the height of the Cold War, might have wanted to see President Kennedy dead. And what we also now know about that Mexico trip is that Oswald was under surveillance by the CIA while he was in Mexico. And the question becomes, did anything happen in Mexico City that is linked to the assassination? And it turns out that while Oswald was in Mexico, he may have been talking openly about his plans to kill the president. And the question becomes, who else knew that in Mexico, and did anybody encourage him to do what he would do in Dealey Plaza?
And what is the motive behind both these agencies of hiding that information?
Well, I mean, the simplest explanation is that they were both terrified that they would be blamed for the assassination, that they missed it. It's very similar to the story of 9/11, that there were dots and they weren't connected.
But by the same token, it does help lead to this man and would do away with a lot of the conspiracy theories that have cropped up over the last five decades.
Well, to some extent, but I am left at the end of the day, at the end of this 5 years of research, wondering just who else knew what Oswald was going to do, and whether or not other people encouraged him to do this, and whether or not people might have been ready to help Oswald if he's ever able to do this and escape. And, you know, that is not my crazy conspiracy theory. That is one that was developed on the Warren Commission staff. One of their staff investigators determines, or is pretty convinced, that Oswald is heading to the border with Mexico after the assassination because somebody is waiting there to help him escape to Cuba. That something happened in Mexico that Oswald was promised, if he could ever kill the president, that they would help him escape. And, you know, that suggests that certainly other people knew and may have helped Oswald with this plot.
You remain convinced that there are questions to be answered, and yet at the end of the day, after this research, you do believe that he was the one who pulled the trigger and the sole person to do so.
I think all of the most credible evidence points to him as the shooter in Dealey Plaza, and the evidence is even more compelling that he kills this Dallas police officer, J.D. Tippit, an hour later. And, you know, the Tippit murder is so cold-blooded, and it's witnessed by so many people. You wonder, what other reason could there be for that murder other than because Oswald knew he was being pursued as the president's assassin?
Philip Sheehan is our guest. He is the author of the new book, A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. One of the aspects of the book I found fascinating had to do with the autopsy of Kennedy's body and the reports of that autopsy. They were originally, the original report describing the autopsy you found out was destroyed. Other critical medical evidence disappeared. The commission staff was never allowed to see photos of the autopsy or x-rays. What happened to all of this stuff?
Well, I mean, it's sort of no surprise that we're left with all these conspiracy theories that involve the condition of the president's body because, you know, the autopsy was in many ways, it was rushed and it was in many ways bungled. And, you know, it probably never should have. The autopsy is performed at the Bethesda Naval Hospital outside Washington, and that was a bad idea from the start because Navy pathologists just don't have the experience with gunshot wounds that their Army counterparts do. And, you know, Mrs. Kennedy insisted that she would stay with the body and she would remain at the hospital until the autopsy was finished. So the autopsy was rushed for that reason alone. And then the night after, you have this jaw-dropping fact that the Navy pathologist who oversaw the autopsy notices that the president, that the original paperwork, the draft autopsy report, and all of the notes from the autopsy room are stained with the president's blood. So he apparently pushes them all into the fireplace in his home and watches them turn to ash. And, you know, his reasons were, you know, he explains that he just doesn't want them turning up in some, you know, awful assassination museum someday stained with the president's blood. But when the staff members of the Warren Commission hear about that, they are alarmed because they think, you know, that sort of destruction of evidence has the makings of conspiracy theories for generations to come.
After the autopsy, the president's brain disappeared.
Yet another mystery, and that is, I mean, that is quite perplexing to understand. But apparently, you know, during the autopsy, the president's brain was removed, which is routine in these sorts of autopsies, apparently, for examination. Then the White House physician asked that the brain be returned to the White House so the brain can presumably be buried with the president's body. But then the brain really disappears past that point. It's given to President Kennedy's former secretary at the National Archives, but it's impossible to track past that point. Congressional investigators tried to find out what became of it. They weren't able to. The assumption seems to be that eventually the brain got into the custody of Robert Kennedy, who may or may not have buried it with his brother's body.
Let's talk about Chief Justice Warren for a moment. As we mentioned, he's doing this really against his will, if and he gets into a lot of fights, including with J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. Well, the two men, you know, hate each other, and they've hated each other for years. And Hoover is quite convinced that Warren is determined to put the FBI out of business and to blame the FBI for the assassination. And the story is throughout the Warren Commission investigation that Hoover is at war with the Warren Commission and he's denying it lots of evidence it needs to do its job.
And the staff itself of the commission are very critical of the job that Chief Justice Warren has done.
You know, I was really surprised to discover how much real turmoil there was on the staff and how often the staff protested what they saw as these terrible decisions that the Chief Justice was making. You know, the Chief Justice makes the decision after seeing the autopsy photos that nobody else will see the autopsy photos, none of the other commissioners, none of the staff, even though the staff felt that the autopsy photos were sort of the essential medical evidence they needed to do their job. There were witnesses that Warren refused to allow to be interviewed by the staff for reasons that were just hugely baffling. And, you know, these are all these unanswered questions, all this missing evidence, all this evidence denied to the staff, you can just see where the conspiracy theories come from.
Indeed. And back to the cast of characters, Arlen Specter is one of those staff members who threatens to quit because he can't see those autopsy photos.
Well, you know, they say this is, you know, Arlen Specter is responsible for the medical evidence. And over the course of months, he is just repeatedly insisting that the Chief Justice change his mind and that the autopsy photos be turned over to the staff. He never succeeds in that, and they remain in the custody of Robert Kennedy at the Justice Department. But Specter writes this remarkable memo to his superiors at the Warren Commission saying, listen, if we don't see those autopsy photos, it's possible there are mistakes in the medical records that if they're not corrected will create conspiracy theories, and he was exactly right about that.
Let us get back to Robert F. Kennedy for a moment, and you talked about the way he acted during this. There is his own private investigation that is going on, and of course also the grief that he's dealing with, and you write in the book that for weeks after the assassination that he would wear the clothes of his brother.
Well, you know, apparently he was just totally shattered by his brother's death. You know, John Kennedy was not only his brother, he was also his best friend. They were, you know, his closest political confidant. You know, Robert Kennedy was never the same person after the death of his brother. And people have said that one of the things that shook him so greatly was the fact that he felt guilty. He thought that something he had done at the Justice Department or working with his brother during the Cuban Missile Crisis or against Castro, that had something to do with the assassination. And, you know, there's reason to believe that Robert Kennedy thought that perhaps Fidel Castro had killed his brother, because the Kennedy brothers, you know, John and Robert, had been behind schemes to kill Castro.
So that is why he launched his own private investigation.
That's part of the reason, yeah. And it's certainly clear that he kept a lot of his suspicions away from the Warren Commission. He writes a very, you know, he's the highest ranking official of the federal government not required to testify before the Warren Commission. The other was President Johnson. And he instead provides the Warren Commission with a very brief note in which he claims that he has no evidence to share with them, no suspicions about a conspiracy. And again, that was just not true. He had plenty of suspicion about a conspiracy.
What was the suspicion, and how plausible is the suspicion against Lyndon Baines Johnson?
Well, you know, there had been books written about that, including a new one. I certainly don't see any credible evidence of it. It's very difficult to imagine, but I certainly don't see any evidence of it.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you wrote a book about the 9/11 Commission, and you touched on this, the Commission, the Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. What parallels do you see between these investigations of trying to get a handle on just unspeakable acts?
You know, in regards to the two commissions?
Yes.
Well, I will tell you that the 9/11 Commission, which I covered very intensively for a couple of years, you know, I think it undeniably did a much better job. And it probably has something to do with the fact that the 9/11 Commission was created during a much more cynical time, when the assumption was that government agencies would try to withhold evidence, that they would have to be forced to share evidence. You know, 1963, 1964 was a more innocent time, and I just don't think the Warren Commission and its staff really expected the government to hide as much information as it did.
When you think of the outcome of the Warren Commission, I found this fascinating in the book, and you're talking with the staffers and the people who were very young at the time, of what they make of their work that they did and how they look at that experience.
Individually, you know, and many of them are still alive. Individually, I think they take great pride in what they did, and you know, it's very clear they really worked their hearts out. Some to the point, really, of physical collapse by the end of it. You know, they were not sleeping; they were just working nonstop. But I think they really are very angry to discover how much information was hidden from them, and you know, how much information would have really changed the findings of the Warren Commission if they'd known about it.
At the end of the day, after all of this research and working so hard on this book, what do you hope their takeaway is?
Well, you know, it was very tightly embargoed, and I praise my publisher for that. And it's really only been out for 10 days, but I've had a very gratifying response from people who say that, you know, suddenly this most mysterious of modern events makes sense in a way it didn't before, that it connects dots in a way that have never been connected before. And I hope that's true, and I think that's true. And I also have I think the book offers some optimism that there is a chance to get some more answers, and that's because some of the people who dealt with Oswald in Mexico City are still alive, and they talked with me for this book, even though they were never questioned by the FBI or the CIA back in 1963 and 1964.
So you believe, you are optimistic that the true story will eventually come out?
Well, no. I think the full true story, no, because too many people have died, too much evidence has disappeared. But I think there is the opportunity to know more, certainly about what may have been going through Lee Harvey Oswald's mind in the weeks before the assassination.
The book is A Cruel and Shocking Act. It is published by Henry Holt. Philip, thank you very much for spending time with us. I do appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is A Cruel and Shocking Act. It is published by Holt. The author is Philip Sheenan. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.